So I'm going to pass around a little sign-up sheet for names and email addresses. It's not so crucial if the email address that you used when you registered is the one that you might like to use to receive a notice about what's happening this week. But if you're local and you aren't, or if you're not officially a registrant but you're just going to be attending, it'd be useful to have your email address in case we need to make last-minute announcements. So
we are registered. Do you want to begin?
You can write it again if you want. I don't need it. Yours I don't need. I know your address by heart. So we're pleased to have Graham Siegel, who will be giving a series of lectures this week on several different topics. And the first lecture or two will be about informal field training.
What? Try to put this in my pocket.
Oh, not informal field day. What did I call it? A mathematician looks at quantum field day. I gave you some title.
This is what I was meant to do with this. I think I may have prepared somewhat the wrong lecture for this occasion. I don't know. What I'm actually going to do is give you some kind of introduction to the first few minutes of Robert Dykgraff's introduction, and I can see that that will be a bit tedious for some people who are here. My lectures aren't actually going to be a continuous sequence. I think I'm going to talk about a number of different topics, so I'll try to make the lectures somewhat self-contained. And I'll be very happy to have feedback and suggestions as to what the other topics might be, because I haven't really decided yet. It's too late, unfortunately, to change this morning's lecture. So what I'm going to talk about now is a lecture. Well, I'm going to give some kind of lecture about the formal structure of quantum field theory. And then perhaps at the end I'll say a little bit about which directions I want to move on towards from that. So in traditional quantum field theory, the important thing is that space-time is given. So we're given a space-time manifold. And so this is completely different from any kind of theory of strings or M's or gravity, because we know what the, so to speak, target is before we start. And the traditional picture is that you are given at each point of this space-time a set of things you can observe. So we're also given a set of observables. Let's call it OX for each X in space-time. And we're meant to be able to observe these things, so we're given functions whenever we take some distinct points of space-time. And that's meant to be all you're given. That's meant to be the complete structure. Now, this space-time manifold is meant to be equipped with some kind of structure, probably at least a Riemannian manifold, a Riemannian metric in proper quantum field theory. And maybe it's going to have some other structure too. But already when I write things like this, I'm assuming that I'm doing some kind of Euclidean version of quantum field theory, because if I wanted to work in Minkowskian space, if I had an indefinite metric, I wouldn't really expect functions like this. I would expect some kind of distributions on the product of copies of X. But in the Euclidean version of the theory, you get honest functions, providing you keep these points separate. Now, whether that's really the fundamental question, or whether you should really try to, so I have in mind that the Euclidean theory is somehow more basic, and we are eventually going to get things in Minkowski space by somehow continuing analytically to the boundary of some Euclidean domain. Whether that's really the right thing, and whether this fact that you have these kind of well-defined local observables is fundamental? That seems to be an interesting question, but that's certainly the point of view that I'm taking here.
Well, of course, behind this,
you see, this is in some sense a kind of pretty weird collection of data. And obviously the mythology behind it is that one has in mind some kind of space of fields on X. Now, these fields might be all kinds of things. They might be, so this is the actual content, and this is meant to be the mythology behind it. What might these fields be? They might be, for example, maps F from X to some auxiliary Riemannian manifold. So that would be the theory that's called a sigma model. Or they might be, for example, a vector bundle with connection on X. That would be another typical example. The important thing about these fields is that they're locally defined on X. So that if you so that to know one of these things, you have to know it at each point separately in X. Now, as already this example makes clear, very often these things aren't really like functions on X. They're very often objects of some category. You see, vector bundles are objects, and one speaks of vector bundles being isomorphic. One's usually interested in the set of isomorphism classes, but one should be clear that one is talking about a category, because it's in that sense that the objects are local. You see, if you give a vector bundle with a connection, then it's not a local object in the sense that if you divide your space into two parts, then you give the isomorphism class on one part and the isomorphism class on the other part, then that determines the bundle with connection on the whole thing, because you have to say how to glue them together. On the other hand, the object itself is locally defined. You have something at each point, the bundle and the little bit of connection at that point. The objects are local, even though the isomorphism classes of objects are commonly not local. And that seems to be a thing that arises all the time in quantum field theory, so I think it's worth mentioning. Well, so one has these fields, and we have the things OX, which are meant to be locally defined functions on phi of X. So again, the emphasis on the local. If one wanted such a thing in this example, you see, one might take some function phi with complex values on that, and then a typical example would be that if we took phi, that would define phi, a function which took f to phi at f of x. You see, it's a function on these fields determined just by the field at the point of x. So it's local in that sense that it only depends on f in the immediate neighborhood of f. Or, for instance, something like, say, the sum of the squares of the entries of the curvature, if you had a bundle with a connection. That would be the Yang-Mills action at that point of a bundle with connection. So one has these locally defined functions, and of course the final classical ingredient is that you have some action functional usual, real value normally, which again is locally defined in the sense that I want to emphasize this all the time, in the sense that SF of field, whatever it is meant to be some kind of integral over X of contribution, some contribution which depends just on the, I'll write that rather schematically, something which just depends on the value of the field at the point
x,
where L is some function which doesn't just depend necessarily on the value, but might depend on the function together with its derivatives at that point. It depends on the whole infinitesimal local behavior at the point, but it doesn't depend on anything anywhere else. And of course, one is interested in doing schematically some integral over the space of fields with respect to some measure, which one writes like this. So one thinks of this as some kind of measure on the space phi of x. And one wants to integrate these local functions. So one wants to integrate things like phi 1 of f, phi k of f, where phi k, phi I is an observable at some point xi. So some locally defined function of f. And this is meant to be the function that we have here. And of course, it's traditionally written and that's the, I should have said that this was how this function was written. Well, so that's the formalism. Now, to what extent does, can one actually, is this a good description? And does one really have examples of these things? And what can one do with them? So what one's trying to do is define a measure on some infinite dimensional space of maps. And one is trying to think of it as being some kind of product measure, just of a rather flabby kind. The best example, clearest example to have in mind is this example of a sigma model, where you might try to put a measure on the space of all these maps, which was simply the product measure of the some Riemannian measure on M applied to the value of F at X, and then take the product measure of that over all X. Well, there certainly is such a measure. It's a perfectly good measure on the space of all set theoretic functions from X to M, not necessarily continuous, smooth, or whatever. So it's something which wouldn't see any geometrical properties of X at all. That's something like this. And then one wants to put geometry into the situation by weighting that measure with something of this kind, which somehow does see the geometry of X. Well, the most famous kinds of example are when you take, for instance, in this case, the integral over x of df star df, where here we're using, first of all, a Riemannian metric on M to be able to measure the length of tangent vectors to M. That's what this outside thing means. And we're using a star operator, a Hodge star operator, which is related to the Riemannian structure on x, to be able to measure the size of the derivative of a map from f to x. This is the standard action that you have for sigma models. Well, you see, this thing, this functional, this is what's traditionally called the energy of a map f in this example. And the critical points of this are what you call harmonic maps from x into m. So this function is small when f is a harmonic map, and it grows rapidly when you move away from the subset of harmonic maps. So one's trying to produce a measure on the space of all maps which is very strongly peaked around the harmonic maps, and then one would like to integrate things with respect to this kind of measure. Now, I think it's worth thinking a little bit about that just from the point of view of ordinary analysis. You see, it's very closely related to the variational study of this functional S of F. And the results that come out are the ones that you would find in variational analysis in mathematics. So let me just say one or two words about that. For instance, if x is one-dimensional, this is the this energy function is the thing whose critical points are the geodesics. And one knows that one has a very good variational control of the geodesic problem. If, for instance, you have a homotopy class of loops in a manifold, you can flow downwards along the gradient flow of the energy and find a geodesic loop in the homotopy class. Or if you take two fixed points and you consider paths in a manifold going from one point to the other, so we're considering paths in M, and you see X is something one-dimensional, then we have a very good hold on this problem. We know that there's always a geodesic of shortest length which goes from one to the other. And we know much more. We know that the thing behaves very well geometrically. We can do what's called Morse theory on this function. From analyzing the critical points of the function, we can find out all about the topology of the space of maps from something one-dimensional into M. Now, if we go to the next stage up, where X is two-dimensional, then again things are in fairly good shape, where we have a good variational theory, but not quite as good as before. We're trying now to make harmonic maps from a surface into some target. It doesn't matter what the dimension of the target is. Well, we know that we can, if we start with any map, we can go downwards in the gradient flow and try to get to a harmonic map. We know that that works with just one proviso, that as you flow downwards in this thing, what will standardly happen is that the map will acquire what are called bubbles. As you change the map will tend to a limit in the neighborhood of everywhere but a finite number of, everywhere except in the infinitesimal neighborhood of a finite number of points of your manifold sigma, where a sort of hernia will happen, and instead of your limit being a map, if we imagine M, we have some surface sitting in it. Typically, when you flow downwards in the gradient flow, you will get at the end a thing which, as a surface sitting in the target, looks like a copy of your manifold with some bubbles coming out of a finite number of points. The example to have in mind is the example of a sequence of rational functions. Imagine you're looking at maps from the two-sphere to the two-sphere. Then, supposing we were to look at a map given by a rational function, think of this as the Riemann sphere, and think of a map like this, P of Z over Q of Z, where these are polynomials. Well, supposing you have a family of maps of this kind, where at a certain limiting point in the family, a root of the numerator coincides with the root of the denominator. If these are polynomials of degree n, this is a map of degree n from S2 to S2, and it will stay of degree n providing there's no cancellation between the P and the Q. But if a root here coincides with a root there, we get polynomials of degree n minus 1, and the degree of the map will jump. If you look at what actually happens to a map when, just imagine, for instance, you had z minus a times z minus b over z minus c, z minus d. Supposing a and c move very close together, then what happens is that this family of maps, as that these move together, tends to a limiting map, which is a map of degree 1, where you cancel that factor and just get z minus b over z minus d. That limit will happen everywhere away from the immediate neighborhood of A and C, where these things are coming together. If you look very carefully at what happens just near these nearby points A and C, then the map will behave very wildly in that little region. It will sweep out the whole of the target S2. And that's typically what happens in this variational situation. But So the more serious, the variational problem is on the edge of being controlled. Essentially, the geometry is well reflected in the space of maps. And that is reflected in the fact that we can do very good quantum field theory in this situation for one-dimensional x and for two-dimensional x. But if we go to three-dimensional x, then the situation becomes very different. If you start mapping a three-dimensional thing into some target manifold and start trying to flow down the gradient flow, then something much worse than bubbling will happen. What will happen is that the maps will cavitate. They will acquire holes. And what you will get when you flow down to the bottom is something that looks like a kind of fishing net rather than a surface with bubbles. You'll just get a total tangle. And so you won't... you see, this function doesn't... It isn't, so to speak, strong enough to control the kinds of maps. And the by flowing along its gradient lines, you don't get back to the harmonic maps you wanted to start with. You just get to messy things which totally tear apart the topology of this. In other words, don't see anything interesting about M. That corresponds to the fact that if you wanted to do this from the in quantum field theory in this situation, if we try to make a field theory of this kind with a target M and a three-dimensional X, we simply wouldn't see M at all. We'd just see a lot of white noise. We'd see what's called a free field theory. And of course, higher dimensional X will be worse still. Well, that's one of the fundamental, the words used in field theory are that if one goes above dimension 2, this problem is not renormalizable, is the way that it's expressed. Yeah. The most famous example is if you start looking at a map, say, of a three-dimensional disk to S2, then you see what you can actually do is take the identity map from S2 to S2 and then extend to a discontinuous map by projecting the three-dimensional disk radially outwards onto the S2, that's the boundary, and then mapping by the identity map, thereby creating a complete hole in the middle. In other words, that's what I meant by cavitating. Now, the point is that cavitating, I mean, in other words, you see, this D3 is mapped to S2 by the identity on the boundary, but everything in the middle is pushed out, so there's a big hole occurs in the map, as if you think of it as a map of the disk into here. Now, that's the kind of thing which you get led to by flowing down the gradient flow on maps. I mean, that map, at least formally, is harmonic, the map, this cavitated map. Well, you have to look at the difference, yeah, I should have explained that. Physicists are very familiar with that renormalizability is all to do with scaling. What is the difference between the three-dimensional situation, the two-dimensional situation, and the one-dimensional situation? Well, you see, supposing you take a little piece of X, this is a little region in X, and you have some map F into M. Let's call that region R or something. Supposing we just look at the action of this map in the region R. Then we can ask the following question. Supposing we just make this region, imagine we're in a small neighborhood so that we can kind of expand or contract R linearly. Supposing we just contract R just radially inwards and leave the map the same, that is to say, just drag F along while leaving its boundary values the same. So, for instance, you see, if we were looking at a path, if this were one-dimensional, we might be looking at a path from somewhere to somewhere described in time t. We consider the same path described in a shorter time. Then the question is whether the action gets bigger or smaller when you do that. If the action gets smaller when you do that, then you can go downhill in the action by squashing the movement of your function into smaller and smaller regions. So therefore, you can tear the map apart while not increasing the action. On the other hand, you see, in the one-dimensional problem, if you want to get from A to B in time t, then you need more and more action to do it as the time gets smaller. The two-dimensional problem is when the sigma model is conformally invariant, then when you scale this thing in, the action is exactly the same. You see, precisely in two dimensions, this thing only depends on the star operator on one forms. That simply rotates one forms by 90 degrees. It's a conformally invariant operation. And that's the critical dimension then for this problem when pushing in leaves the action the same. So you can get bubbles which carry off finite bits of action, but you don't get anything worse. The higher dimensional thing, you see, you can completely create a tear while not using any action at all. That's the geometrical background to the kind of things we're trying to do in quantum field theory. And I wanted to emphasize that people think of these integrals as totally fanciful. I wanted to emphasize that the questions we're asking are perfectly sensible geometrical questions which people study in other parts of mathematics. In quantum field theory, one tends to study them in a rather formal algebraic way. For instance, if you're really interested in the sigma model, the crucial thing would be whether the target x had positive or negative curvature. If you look at a negatively curved target manifold, then despite what I said there, cavitation will not occur, and there is, for instance, a unique harmonic map in each homotopy class of maps. On the other hand, positively curved ones, you get this sort of bad behavior that is what I've been talking about. Now, of course, if you just do a formal local analysis, you won't distinguish between these things of positivity or negativity. On the level of formal power series, you don't see that. And so in the physics of perturbation theory, you don't see that. Okay, well, anyway, let me now change ground a bit and talk about formalizing this situation. You see, supposing one really wants to do quantum field theory all the same, how might one try to make mathematical sense out of it? Well, I've always greatly disliked this way of talking about quantum field theory, which is traditional, for a number of reasons, but the most basic one is that particularly if you're interested in applications of this in, say, string theory, one of the things you want to do is think of two-dimensional quantum field theories as some kind of analogs of Riemannian manifolds. And so just as you're interested in the moduli space of manifolds of a certain kind, you're interested in varying, say, the Riemannian metric on a manifold. After all, that's what gravitation is all about. One would like to be able to talk, say, about families of quantum field theories, talk about a moduli space of two-dimensional theories of a certain kind, and so on. Well, this kind of perspective is very bad from that point of view, because you have to give a manifold and you have to give a set of observables at each point before you can even kind of discuss what the theory is. And of course, one knows examples where you give a theory in terms of certain kinds of observables and you find that it can be reformulated in terms of completely different set of observables. I mean, even without changing the mythology behind it, so to speak, just on this level, you can give different descriptions of the same theory. So one would like a more, one would like, if possible, some other way of saying what a theory is than this picture here. Well, it's sort of fairly common ground, I dare say. The thing that one wants to, you see, if one has a theory, one wants to say what properties these functions ought to have. And the way in which the physics is encoded in them is the following. You see, supposing you have your manifold X and you have some points where you're going to measure things, and supposing you cut this manifold into two halves. So let's call this half X1 and this half X2. Then one can ask, and we observe some things phi1 to phi k at these points, x1 to xk. supposing the first, supposing x1 to xi is in x1, and xi plus 1 to xk is in x2, then we can ask the question, is this a product somehow of something which only depends on the x1 part and something which depends on the x2 part? Is that likely to be the case? Well, you see, obviously not. If we had done, if we didn't, if this action had been simply the product of some function of the value of f at each point, in other words, if the Lagrangian, this thing L of f, didn't have any derivatives of f in it, then this measure, at least formally, would be a product of things over all the points of x. It would be e to minus L of f at x dx times d mu x. It would be a product of that over all points of x on a formal level. And then, of course, you would expect to be able to write the integral over all f, over all f defined at these points, just by Fubini's theorem, as an integral over all the points on one side and integral over all the points on the other side. And then you would expect to get a factorization property like this. But then, of course, there would be no physics, because the behavior of this part of the universe would have nothing to do with the behavior at this part of the universe. There'd be no interaction between these two things. On the other hand, so what we're crucially encoding is the local nature of this function. So that this isn't just a function of the value. On the other hand, it also isn't a function which involves relationships between the value at points which are not infinitesimally close. It's a function which we get by integrating over x something that involves the derivatives. So the measure on the face of it links together infinitesimally nearby points. And therefore, what happens when you make this cutting, supposing y is this membrane on which we cut x, what actually happens is that there appears associated to x, to y, this cutting is associated a vector space, usually a Hilbert space, hy. And this can be written as an inner product in this Hilbert space hy of something associated to the left-hand part and to the right-hand part. So we might write that in this kind of notation like that. Well, this is not a number, but is something which we have when we have a manifold with a boundary, y, and takes its values in this. Now, on the mythological level, you see, what we would be doing is saying that to integrate over all functions, say, f from x into m, we have to decide what the boundary value of f is on the interface, and we would integrate over all things with a given value. So this would be a function in some sense, a function on the space of f from y into m in that sense, and so would this be. So we would have got this by integrating over all f's defined on x1 with a given boundary value, this likewise, then we multiply the two contributions and integrate all over all the boundary values. So that's the formal structure. Well, one can ask for that to be an axiom system, and then you get led to a formal definition of a theory where you say that a QFT, a quantum field theory of dimension D, consists of two kinds of data. It consists of something which takes
d minus one dimensional manifolds y, you know, topological vector spaces hy, then that's meant to be functorial in y with whatever kind of structure y might have, it's Riemannian metric or whatever. The only properties one, the essential property one wants this to have is again something that reflects the locality of the whole picture. That, so that if one took a Y that was a disjoint union of two different, so these are meant to be closed manifolds, because we're contemplating cutting things along closed manifolds. If Y is like this, you expect H of Y to be the tensor product in some appropriate sense, which I won't talk about now. So that's the first half of the data, something which tells us how we're going to do cuttings. And secondly, well, you see, the you see already in this picture, we paired things associated to one half and to the other half. So the function here of the function f on the boundary played a slightly different role according to whether it was the boundary of the thing on the one side or on the other side. We want to keep those things separately. So if this is an oriented manifold, the boundary acquires a natural orientation. You can call that the outgoing orientation. There's an opposite possible orientation that you could call the ingoing orientation. Well, we'd like to keep track of both of those things. And so it's best to consider cobordisms from, I write it like this. So that is meant to indicate that X is a d-dimensional manifold, oriented, whose boundary is given as a union of two pieces, y naught and y one. And we'd like to associate to that a that this gives an operator h y naught to h of y one. And one might place different kinds of conditions on the operator in different situations. Notice that that includes this picture, because you see, if we had the picture here, the first thing is we conclude from this axiom that if y is empty, then this space is just the complex numbers, the unit for tensor product. So something like x1 is a cobordism from the empty set to y, it should correspond, x1 should give us something from the complex numbers into h of y, let's call that ux1, but I didn't give this a name, so I'll call it ux. that's the same thing as giving a vector in here. On the other hand, this thing should give us a cobordism from y to nothing, so it should give us a map that way, so it should give us something in the dual space. We put the two together and get a number, and that's the pairing I have here. So I've encoded that in that picture. Well, to what extent can one actually, I mean, is this really a sensible perspective?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Unoriented?
It doesn't, no, in that, but it would, I'm taking these things to be oriented in the way I'm saying it. One could, of course, ask, one could say, can it happen that this doesn't depend on the orientation? Well, if it did, then one would have, if it's going to be independent of the orientation, there will have to be a natural bilinear form on H of Y, which would identify it with its dual. That would be part of saying that the thing didn't depend on the orientation. So one could certainly have that, but I'm not I'm allowing the thing to depend on the orientation. That's the more general option. I first suggested this is essentially a kind of joke, really, this formulation. But I've come to think that it
makes quite good sense. Let me say one or two things by way of propaganda for it. The first thing is, the great advantage of this approach to the subject, as I see it, is that you don't get involved with deciding beforehand. I mean, you give this and nothing else. So it's you don't need to give these observables at the different points. See, where do the observables come in? You see, where do the observables come in? If we have our x and we have our points, x1, x2, and so on, then we can imagine putting little disks around these points. If you delete those disks, you have a thing x0, which you can think of as being a cobordism from a bunch of d-1 dimensional spheres around the various points. Will be some kind of cobordism from that to the empty set, because X is meant to be a closed manifold. So it will give you a map from the space for these spheres. And I'd like to think of those as the expectation values, those functions that we had up there. In other words, I'd like to define O of X simply as the inverse limit, strictly speaking, of these spaces over the family of disks getting smaller and smaller as you come into a point. So this is something which you could do quite generally. Given a data of that kind, we attach to each point X the inverse limit. Or if you like, just take one, just imagine taking one very small disk, and the things you can observe there are simply the things you will get on in the vector space associated to a very small sphere around that point. The different small spheres, you see, are related by the fact that if one small sphere is contained in the other, then we have a cobordism between them and a map from the H of one sphere to H of the other. Now, of course, in two-dimensional conformal field theory, for those of you who know it, of course, it's very well known that the observables are simply the states, so-called, because in two-dimensional conformal field theory, well, I haven't come to that yet, any little circle is the same as any other little circle, and so there's just one one-dimensional manifold, and we only have one vector space H really in the game. But of course, in a more general theory, you shouldn't think that the space associated to cutting around a little sphere there will be the same as the space associated to making a large cut somewhere else. So I'm not saying that in all theories we have a correspondence between observables and states. That's an aside to those who are familiar with two-dimensional field theory. So do examples of this situation actually arise, and what can one do with them? Well, as already... perhaps I should just tell you... you see, in two-dimensional conformal field theory, the vector spaces are associated to one-dimensional manifolds. Those one-dimensional manifolds are just bunches of circles, so we really just have a space associated to a circle, and the circle has no structure because in conformal field theory we don't require a metric but only a conformal structure. There's nothing on a circle, so there's just one vector space around, and that serves both as the thing for factorizing states, and it also serves then as the observables at each point.
Different,
yeah. Actually, well, Okay, so perhaps I have to be a bit more honest about this. I'm telling you, I'm cheating a bit, and perhaps I'd better be more honest. The thing that I've been modeling for you is not quite meant to be the most general kind of field theory. It's meant to model the situation where you had something like a sigma model and a target X which was compact. Now, of course, that's not the thing one in general wants to model. One would want to allow non-compact M's. And then, of course, if you just think about it quite crudely,
let's see. Let's even think about the case. Can I postpone that just for a moment, actually? And I'll come back to what I want to say if M not compact. So let me just talk about the basic examples of this. It'll be easier to come back to it later. If D is 1, this is the case that Robert talked about at the beginning of his talk, what things do we have? We simply have points and cobordisms. If the cobordism has a Riemannian metric, that has no property but its length. So we have a space associated to a point, and we have an operator which you can call UT associated to this, and the axiom, which I possibly forgot to say over there, the basic axiom is when you string together cobordisms, the operators compose, so you have a one parameter semigroup of operators. And the basic example of the basic realization of this situation is meant to describe a particle moving in a Riemannian manifold when the space H, as Robert explained, was L2 of M, and the operator was e to minus t times the Laplacian of M. And that encodes the eigenvalues of the Laplacian and nothing more. So if you think of this as a one-dimensional field theory, which is meant to reflect this mythological picture, you can ask, well, how much of this mythological picture is actually contained in the structure? Well, precisely the spectrum of the Laplacian, and recovering M from that is the classical problem of Mark Katz. Can you hear the shape of a drum? Can you recapture a manifold from the spectrum of Laplacian? It's well known that you can't, although you get a lot of information. You can get, say, the dimension of M, the volume of M, the Euler number of M, all sorts of information can be extracted, but not all of M. That's for a compact M. Now, what would happen here if M were not compact? Perhaps we should have considered there are not many other possible one-dimensional cobordisms, but we could have had things like this, for instance, which should have given us maps in principle from L2 of M, tensor L2 of M, to the complex numbers, and also something back the other way. What would these maps be? These would be this would be the thing which was pairing with the heat kernel between the two points. We'd have some. This thing would be given by an integral operator, say with kernel kt of xy, x and y running through M, and this would be the integral operator defined by that. And similarly, the thing got by regarding it as a cobordism the other way would be putting the heat kernel in as a function like that. Now, of course, if you think of the heat kernel as a function of two variables, it will be something peaked when x and y are small. So, for instance, imagine this is something which will be like some kind of Gaussian-shaped form along, if you think of this as L2 of m cross m, would be some kind of Gaussian-shaped thing along the diagonal in m.
So if M were not compact, it wouldn't be an L2 function. You immediately see that in the non-compact case, you have to consider two opposite kinds of things. You have to consider a space which contains things like the constant function 1, and you have to consider another space which contains things which you can integrate over M. So the picture is this, that in the non-compact situation, you should have two spaces associated to a point, an incoming one and an outgoing one, and you should have operators. We should only consider cobordisms where each connected component of the cobordism has a non-empty outgoing boundary. Perhaps I better write that down. So, non-compact theory then. We have y goes to h of y as before, but you have u of x from h of y naught to h of y1. This is meant to be associated to a cobordism. This is meant to be defined only when each component, each connected component of X has outgoing boundary non-empty. So, for instance, we would allow that, but we wouldn't allow this. And there would then be a dual space. It will follow from the axioms when you write it all down properly, but it will be the dual space, and there will be another class of operators associated to ones which have non-empty incoming boundaries. So we will kind of have a compact supported space and a non-compactly supported space, and the local operators will be related to the one kind of thing and the propagation operators to the other. And for instance, in two-dimensional Liouville theory, which is one of the famous non-compact two-dimensional conformal field theories, you have these two kinds of state spaces.
So that would actually just both the outgoing components would just be ordinary correlation functions.
Yeah, yes. The ones that the correlation functions will be the ones defined for where the non-empty initial space and possibly empty final space, whereas the observables you see will be from things with empty incoming and non-empty outgoing. So they'll be opposite sorts of things. So we'll have two essentially dual things. Perhaps let's make it a little bit clearer formally in the next thing I'm going to say. So can you wait just a little bit more? It'll perhaps become a tiny bit clearer. Well, actually, I spent perhaps too long talking all about that formal structure. There were actually two things I wanted still to say in this lecture, and maybe I'm only going to have time to explain one of them. Well, I feel that's a bit cruel.
No, we scheduled it for an hour and 15 deliberately.
Dennis? Oh, you didn't tell Robert that.
Yes, you did.
I feel an hour is enough to listen to anyone. And besides, I have to give five of these lectures. So. let me tell you the two things that I was planning to say, which go in somewhat opposite directions. Just to say a few words about one of the things. Supposing this kind of axiom system that I've been talking about has really only been used in situations which are rather far away from genuine quantum field theories of the sort that physicists traditionally studied. They've been used only for theories which are very much more rigid than classical quantum field theories, namely so-called topological field theories, where the spaces and operators just depend on smooth manifolds and not on any Riemannian structure on them. Or else in dimension two, they've been used to study conformal field theories. Conformal field theories are things defined by this system when the cobordisms, which are surfaces, are given a conformal structure but not a chosen Riemannian structure. That's the definition of a two-dimensional conformal theory. And those things are not really of interest, at least to string theorists, as far as I know, as quantum field theories in their own right. They're of interest as sort of intermediate objects out of which something like string theory is constructed. But I believe that this framework is actually of interest for studying field theories in any event. In other words, when there is a Riemannian metric. The only examples, or almost the only examples I could give where, which involve a Riemannian metric, are the free boson and fermion theories on general curved backgrounds. And it seems to me there are some quite interesting things to be said about those, but I think I will not spend my remaining 4.5 minutes telling you about those, but conceivably I'll do that in another lecture if anyone's interested. That would involve more questions of analysis, determinants, regularizing determinants of Laplace operators, and so on. Instead, I'll talk about the formal structure. Because one reason for being interested in this framework is that a field theory is defining something rather analogous to a commutative ring. We discussed one-dimensional theories and saw there wasn't very much to say. Supposing we consider the next case, d equals 2, then, again, we have only essentially one closed, oriented, one-dimensional manifold circle, and that will give rise to a vector space H of S1, which we might as well just call H. And as Robert explained in his talk, cobordisms between surfaces will give us maps from tensor products of these to tensor products. In particular, the pair of pants, this corresponds to a map from H tensor H to H. Well, now if we were doing this, so now we have to consider what kind of theories we want to consider. If we were considering proper field theories, these things ought to be Riemannian manifolds, then a circle would have an invariant, namely its length, and we would have not just one space H, but a one parameter of spaces, one for each length of circle. And we would have to take that one parameter variation seriously. However, if we're interested in two-dimensional conformal theories, so we only have conformal structures on these things, then we have no data at all on a circle. Any circle is the same as any other circle. And we have just one space. And we have an operator U sigma that just depends on a conformal structure on sigma. Now, the simplest kind of theory to analyze is a so-called topological theory where you don't ask for any data on sigma beside its structure as a smooth manifold. And then it's an ancient folk theorem. I don't know who discovered it. I was told it by Daniel Friedan about 15 years ago. But there have been innumerable proofs published by various people in the mathematical literature since of the fact that a two-dimensional topological theory is exactly the same thing as a commutative Frobenius algebra, H. What does that mean? Well, certainly a two-dimensional theory gives us a vector space associated to the circle, and this operation gives us a multiplication. So we certainly have a vector space with a bilinear multiplication. It's certainly associative because
You see, if we multiply two things together and then multiply them by a third, that will correspond to a cobordism from three circles to one circle, which looks like this. And if you're only interested in the topology of this, the differential manifold aspect, and not interested in any metric, that's exactly the same thing as doing a pair of pants based on these two and then feeding in the third. So that this multiplication will be associative. Slightly less obvious is that it's commutative. There's a diffeomorphism of sigma, which is the identity on the boundary circles, which is the identity on the outgoing boundary circle that interchanges the two incoming boundary circles. So that's slightly less obvious, but it's true. So you have a commutative multiplication. You have a 1 in this algebra because you can think of a disk as a cobordism from nothing to a circle. That would correspond to a map there. And it's an identity for multiplication because of this fact. That picture collapses just to a cylinder from circle to circle. This defines an element 1 in H. So it's a commutative algebra with a 1. And this thing, the other way around, defines a map, which I'll call theta, from H to C. And it's a trivial remark that in this theory, the map that takes AB to theta of AB, that means we take two things, A and B in H, we multiply them by this operation, and then we cap off. So that means we actually act with a cobordism like that. It follows immediately from the geometry of surfaces that this is a non-degenerate pairing. H. Now, a commutative algebra with a 1 and with such a non-degenerate pairing, so we're given the algebra together with this theta, that's what you call a commutative Frobenius algebra. And it's not hard to convince yourself that if you give this data, then you can recapture the whole theory. So it simply encodes this no more, no less. What examples does one have of such structures? Well, because I want to stop now and I want to give a kind of partial answer to Robert's question, one natural example of this, except that it's mod 2 graded and not quite commutative, supposing we had a compact manifold M and we took its cohomology with complex coefficients. That, if you don't mind the fact that we have odd dimensional things and hence anti-commutativity, so it's in some super context, but let's not mind that for the moment. That, together with the operation of integrating over M, is an example of a commutative Frobenius algebra, if M is an oriented compact manifold. If I considered the appropriate formalization of the non-compact theories, I would have formalized exactly the properties of the cohomology of a manifold with boundary. There would be a thing H of M and a thing H star of M with compact supports. And one would have cobordisms going one way, so to speak, and the other would have cobordisms going the other way. And so a two-dimensional non-compact theory would be the thing whose typical example was this kind of analog of a Frobenius algebra you'd have for a manifold with boundary. The other thing which I think I should stop, so I'll just say the other piece of what might have been. In string theory, one is interested in these objects because they're analogs of commutative rings, and commutative algebras are in some sense analogs of spaces. Robert mentioned thinking of the string theory space as the differential forms on the loop space of some hypothetical space-time that was out there
that one was trying to investigate by the string theory. Right? We didn't know about the space-time except insofar as it was reflected in some particular conformal field theory. So we want to think of a two-dimensional theory as some kind of analog of a commutative algebra. If it were a topological theory, it would literally be a commutative algebra, and we could talk about its spectrum and get a space. If it's a conformal field theory, then this multiplication is not just a single multiplication, but it's a family of multiplications depending on a conformal structure on a disk. So that's really a finite dimensional parameter space of theories. And so it's some way of going from commutative algebras to some more general algebraic structure, which is closely analogous to the non-commutative geometry program, which generalizes commutative algebras to non-commutative algebras and tries to think of the non-commutative algebras as corresponding to a more sophisticated kind of space. So this is the baby formalization of that. Now, how do non-commutative algebras, however, fit into this formalization? Well, it would be natural to talk about theories which were defined on when the manifolds that we were using in our cobordisms themselves were manifolds with boundary. And if we then did that in two dimensions, we would have the kind of thing which is studied in open string theory, where we have two basic manifolds, an interval and a circle, and we have cobordisms between bunches of these things. So, for example, we might have a piece of surface coming along like this, and a piece of surface coming along like this, and they might... I don't think I'm very good at drawing this. I can only draw it more schematically. Supposing we had, say, a circle as our incoming boundary of a surface, and we think of that as undergoing a cobordism, where after a certain point, the outgoing boundary splits into a piece of free boundary, that's something like this, and a piece of boundary that we're keeping track of. So the outgoing boundary might consist of an interval together with some other part, which I think of as free boundary. So supposing we allow structures like that, then what one finds, and I'll probably talk about this in a later lecture, is that the algebraic structure corresponding to this is a pair of objects. We have just corresponding to the closed ones, the commutative Frobenius algebra we had before. Corresponding to open ones, we have another vector space with a multiplication associated to that kind of cobordism, where two intervals join together to form a third interval. But we also have maps between the two things. And this thing corresponds to a commutative Frobenius algebra together with a non-commutative Frobenius algebra, a homomorphism of algebras from this one into the center of that one, and a kind of trace map, what is called in operator algebra theory a conditional expectation, which maps one back to the other. Anyway, that will be exploring the relations of that with non-commutative geometry. It's one of the things I hope to talk about in later lectures, but I'm sure I should stop for now. High-dimensional theories.
Yes.
I'd like to say a three-dimensional. No, I haven't thought about that at all. Well, not enough to have anything to tell you, I think. Yes. I mean, there is a question, actually, of course, which is related, but not quite the same. Suppose you have a theory of the kind I started off with, which is defined on open surfaces, then one of the natural things that you questions you want to ask is, supposing you have a vector space associated to a closed D minus one dimensional thing. Supposing you cut that into half, how can you recapture the space for the closed manifold from two objects associated to the two halves? And that leads you to a theory which is, of course, closely related to this question. But it's not quite the same question. It's also important, though, I think. Well, I'll tell you. I'd be very glad if people will tell me what they'd like me to talk about, because I'm not very clear which way I'm actually trying to go in these lectures.
Okay, thank you again.